we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to the first recording of 2025. Not quite sure when this is going to go out. I think probably somewhere around mid-February time. But on this session today, I've got Stephen Harvey, who I met for the first time in person walking around Brisbane at the World Cup, Women's World Cup. And I heard this, "Hey, Gareth." I'm like, "What?" And he was like, "Duh, duh." So it was a really spooky situation to be walking around a foreign nation. I've been on his book club, which is really cool. And now I get to reciprocate and get Steve back. And as with all of these podcasts, it's about exploring these second stories, these context-rich, messy stories. We hear the first simple story, the linear, blame-focused one. But actually, there's way more to this. And it's not just sharp-end operators. It's also people at management level and senior leaders all have local rationality. Their decisions make sense to them at that time, given their goals, their drivers, their processes, and their experiences. And what we do is we talk about those. So, Stephen, over to you. Where are you? What do you do? How can people find you? And how did you get to where you are now? And where are you going?
That's lots to take in. That might chew up all your time on this little chat.
Quick bit. Then.
Like you said, I saw you in Brisbane and you just tried to run away from me, but I managed to catch you, which was very fortunate. And I'm a quick runner. And as you can probably tell, everyone who's listening in, I'm not totally Australian, although I have had the chip removed from my shoulder and I live in Brisbane now and I have been here in Australia for 22 years now, mate. I can't believe it. Longer than I lived in the UK, I think. I'm 40. So I'll tell you my story. I used to be a mechanic. I trained as a car mechanic in the mother country in Scotland, and then I moved to London just south of London, and I worked for Volvo. And Volvo were looking for techs in Australia because all those techs were going to work in the mines and make serious coin and serious cash. So Volvo said to me, "Hey, we need some young people," and I was young then, Gareth. we need some young people to fix our cars overseas. Would you be keen? And I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm up for that." So I ended up in Sydney, Australia, which was amazing. And after 6 months, I remember saying to the people, I was like, "I'm not going back. I'm staying here." And basically, mate, that's really how I got to Australia. But how I got into safety is I actually suffered a bit of a... We should talk about this one, but I suffered a bit of a traumatic event when a car collapsed off one of the hoists I was working on the lift. And it nearly killed me. I was very, very lucky. I was...
Were you paying attention then?
Yeah, I wasn't paying attention, mate, and I was doing everything wrong that you could possibly do wrong, according to the investigation report that everybody... And apparently it happened before as well, which was very interesting. Obviously just not as serious, mate. But yeah, mate, that was a pretty traumatic... And in hindsight, it was the best thing that ever happened to me because it put me on this journey, and I definitely earn a lot more money now than I did when I was twirling spanners. But, mate, that was really... So that was 2006 that occurred... And I've been in safety really since then, but I only really started thinking about safety in a progressive way, let's say, in about 2014, 2015, that's when I really started. And that's still a long time. That is
10 years ago.
That's probably when I started thinking about the world in a different way, which was leaving me frustrated.
Yeah,
because I thought I was the only one that fought this way. But yeah, that, so that's basically what I've been doing. And anybody who wants to catch up with me, you can get me on LinkedIn, find my YouTube page, follow me on Instagram. I'm quite active on Instagram and all those sort of things. Have a look for Safety Boy, B-H-O-Y, which is a little acknowledgement to my football team in Glasgow. So, yeah, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. Always happy to chat and always happy to share funny videos and things like that. So.
Excellent, that's, excellent. Yes, and funny is one of your bits of being a stand-up comedian as well. So
yeah,
you bring all that stuff across.
Yeah, but Gareth, like, I'd finished my grad certificate at Griffith. I'm one of those other ones that have always been to Griffith, right? Everyone goes to Griffith in Brisbane.
Or Lund, right. There we go.
Yeah, Lund, yeah, Lund or Griffith, right? So I went to Griffith and I was like, what am I going to do next? I thought, I could do human factors, I could do psychology, or I was really keen on marketing. Because I thought, how can we think about safety and marketing? And and then I saw this stand-up comedy course come through and I thought, oh, I've got to have a crack at that. And I actually think that's transformed the way that I deliver my safety training and programs. And I really do. I think that's something that maybe we can learn probably a wee bit more from comics and just the way that people write, etc. So, yeah, that was an awesome little diversion. I still plan to go to uni, but I don't know what I want to do now. I think I'm going to try and I've enrolled in an AI course to help me get stronger in that. So there might be something in that world. Who
Excellent.
Knows? Yeah,
excellent.
Lots of time.
No, that's good. That's good. So we'll put the links to where you can find Stephen in the show notes, and especially his YouTube channel that goes there. So the first bit then is, you know, this sort of first segue into the story is these first stories, the sort of linear, simple story. So Stephen, tell us the first story of the event that you want to discuss.
Yeah, the first story, I had worked for a labour hire company, and
what is a labour hire company? You talked about it in the sort of the preamble. And it's not a firm that I've come across before.
Oh, geez, okay. It's like an on hire workforce.
Okay.
You know, like you take casual labour, and they go and work for like a factory. A company will say, I need 10 people. Can you supply me 10 people? We would supply 10 people, and then they would be the host employer.
Gotcha.
So I worked for like Australia's largest labour hire organisation, and it was amazing, mate. It was like, one minute I could be in like a Bonds underwear shop. And then the next minute, I could be in a mine site. Just the variety of work was incredible. Yeah. So, but unfortunately, I got to see lots of pretty nasty occurrences because labour hire people are pretty vulnerable to work. I used to always say to the host employers, actually, is when you're finished with our people, ask them where they were a bit nervous to work. Ask them where they put their fingers and thought, where did they feel uneasy? Because they always find a weakness in your system.
Yeah.
Always, 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 always. And unfortunately, I mean, you know, let's say I've seen some pretty traumatic events. And the one I was going to talk about is I was doing some work I was asked to go to a mine site after a fatality that occurred with a mechanic. And he was a tyre fitter, this young man. When I say young, he was 50. I actually got to read a bit of his story as well afterwards. It really brings it home when you start. And this guy had a massive influence on my career, unfortunately. But he was a tyre fitter, and while he was conducting a tyre replacement, the tyre exploded, the rim exploded, and obviously there's a mass engulfment of the pressure release, right? You know, this poor man, he was killed instantly. And there was someone working with him, an apprentice, and he lost his arm in the same event. So the first for me, like, I remember meeting people, and the reason I was asked to go and look at this occurrence was because at my company had the same sort of roles in other mine sites and different locations. So we wanted to know if the same thing could happen to our people. So I went up, had a look at this, and everyone saying, you know, he wasn't using the right tools, you know, he wasn't paying attention. But my very favourite one, Gareth, was that I met with someone and he said if he'd just followed the procedure, he would have been fine. Now, to me, that made me very cranky because I said to him, like, mate, he's a mechanic. Mechanics don't follow procedures. Mechanics get the work done. That's how they do it. And I actually asked him to see the procedure and it was like 14 pages long and it had hyperlinks all the way through it. And I was just, I just laughed at him. And he was another person. The influence he's had on my career after was just incredible. So that was kind of, I've never forgotten that.
That piece about procedures reminds me of one of the first episodes we did with Josh Bryant. And it was like, you know, and this was page 14, 39 of the process, of which nobody would read. And I think, you know, it's really easy. And those simple stories we just talked about, those first stories, they should just follow the procedure. And then understand, actually, what does procedure look like? And, you know, before we started, I was talking about the trip that I've just done to Austria and snowboarding. And it's like, how would you teach a robot, in effect, a brand new worker, a robot, how to snowboard on snow and ice in a busy piste? And the tacit knowledge that we develop over time, that we know that we react to or respond to what's going on around us. And a lot of the time, we're not even thinking about what's happening. And so we're operating in fast work time. And in hindsight, it's really easy to turn around and go, there we go. I can see where that failure is. And that's really what the purpose of the, I'm going to say the third part of this podcast is, understanding the second story. What's that context-rich story that goes into this? So it makes sense for somebody to be operating in that environment. And, you know, from my perspective, I'm making an assumption that these are not small wheels either. When you talk about mining vehicles, these are probably sort of 5-6 foot size rims that you're dealing about.
Yeah, very, very large, mate, and you can imagine the releasing pressure. And you've probably seen videos on YouTube or Instagram or whatever for people have been messing around with truck tires, and you just have that sort of release of pressure, and it blows people away, right? And I don't know if fortunate's the right word, but it was quite healing for me, as I met a lot of the people who were there on the site, and at the vehicle that was involved in the event actually was parked up to the side and had the tape and all around it. It was just like, it was just hearing those people tell their stories about what happened and this person, he was just a guy that was trying to feed his family, you know, like he was 50 years old, Steve. He was 50 years old and he's probably done that job like hundreds of times, right?
Yeah.
It's not thousands of times, mate. And that's what I mean. It really resonated with me that he was a mechanic. And, you know, like I know when I was a mechanic, I never used any procedures. I used to break stuff and then go, oh, I better read the instructions. Because that's the way we've done stuff, right? And it's kind of still is the way I do it now. Like if I'm building something, I'll feel my way through it. And and it's a judgment that comes with it, Gareth. It's one of the things that, not even in the case of that mining incident, but because I've been involved with so many, I do this deliberately, accidents, right? Because as soon as I hear the word accident, that triggers a whole different level of thinking for me and this finding the second stories.
And it's just
a judgment that comes with it, you know. And I remember being particularly enraged with the person saying, oh, if he just followed the procedure, he would have been fine. Mate, there's a whole level of controls that need to go in and doing this work. And
So what did normal work look like then? You know, what are the drivers? And, you know, some technical failure occurred, but there's a whole bunch of context that's there. So what does normal look like for that sort of operation? And what are the drivers? Yeah. You know, you could sit there and go, here's the controls where you should have a cage. You put this stuff in to control that energy. But actually, it's understanding what prevents those things from occurring. So what's the deeper side of that?
Well, because those truck tires are so big, you don't put them in cages. You can.
There we go. There's something for me.
They're just massive. What they do have is an exclusion zone away from the area. And I dare say there'll be people jumping in here saying he doesn't know what he's talking about. This is 10 years ago, right? But I know from when I was doing, I had to go and look at the work for the my people afterwards. Yeah. They had an exclusion zone and they would be quite far away when the tyre was being inflated. I believe in the case of the one that exploded, the guy had went up to it and something wasn't right and then tapped it, I believe, with a hammer and it created this massive explosion. But that's kind of, that's normal work is you put yourself away in an exclusion zone very far away with big hoses, etc. So if something does go wrong, at least you've got that sort of distance away from then. So,
but just the bit then is that normal work or is that work as imagined? Is that what should happen or is that what does happen? And so it's understanding those gaps between the procedure that's written down, the process, you know what goes into that versus the reality of the situation that often there are time pressures involved. And again, people would say, but you've got to stop the job. And it's like, that's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, I spent a lot of my time in the diving space and people can thumb a dive at any time for any reason. But you've got to know that there is a growing risk. You've got to know that something is wrong. You've got to have experience of those things. So understand a little bit more about that local rationality. And the hard bit is, unfortunately, this person's not here to ask those questions. But there are others around that we can talk to and say, what does normal look like? Not what does that failure look like, but what does normal look like?
Yeah, mate. And you always see, and you've always heard those stories, but it's like, we all do it like that. That's just the way it happens. The guy I was telling you about earlier, you know, like you need that relentless curiosity, don't you, about work and really just sort of understanding. And I would say this to even hardened people in oil and gas. And they would go, the procedure is there and it needs to be followed. And I was like, I'm guaranteeing, I can promise you it's not being followed. Or there'll be some deviation that the guys have come up with. And they probably don't even see it as an issue.
Yeah.
But if you go and look at it and you start to talk to them about it, they'll go, oh yeah, but I don't have this, that, or the next thing. I don't have this, or I don't have these tools in places. You're right, you know, it's just like, this is the mystery of safety, isn't it? It's like, there's so much happening that you hear the guys talking about safety being a wicked problem, and that's something I've really tapped onto a lot in the past year about this safety just being like a big mystery and you're constantly trying to solve it. And it's something, like I say, Gareth, it's something that I've really tapped into that I've been thinking about a lot. Like, there's just so much work happening and people are doing these they don't make it. They probably don't even know they're doing it half time. Yeah. These deviations and all this different kind of work.
Just change the language. It's one of the bits that I've picked up from Ivan and Adam Johns as well. Is this bit about the attribution of deviation? And deviation infers that there is some level of intent and control that's associated with that.
Yeah.
And just changing the language to say adaptations. There's a Dutch Air Force researcher, I can't pronounce his second name, Leonie. She's written some great papers talking about local ingenuity as another way of solving problems in real time to the situations that are there. And it requires that curiosity. And the interesting piece that Leonie brought out was when she was having discussions with frontline operators and said, you know, do you need to adapt and work around the procedure to get the goals done? And pretty much everybody says yes. And then you speak to the middle management and they had to, I see James Pomeroy posted something yesterday about Janus and having two faces. And so downhill facing the workers, there is an acknowledgement of the workarounds to get the job done, to achieve the goals, which they as management are setting. But conversely, facing uphill into headquarters, there is a sort of, everybody's following the rules. We don't have any accidents, therefore we're safe. And then you end up at the headquarters level that we don't have accidents, and we don't have accidents because we've been told that people are following the rules, and therefore the rules are what makes things safe. And so where you are within the system seriously changes things as well. And it's that perspective that says, you know, you've got to get out there and find out, actually, what does that tapping look like for that big wheel? What's the purpose of that?
Because there must have been some rationality for that individual to go, you know what, this, you know, from my, what I've understood from you is that tire's not inflating as it should do. It's not operating how I expect it to do, but I have got some problems and some goals to solve. And just thinking on my feet now, if you've got a half, you know, I don't know whether or not you can depressurize those tires when you're pumping them up. So you sit there and go, okay, so I've got a problem. How do I solve that when I've got live energy that needs to be dealt with? Well, there's a process that I've seen in the past, and I've seen somebody do it myself, and I've done it myself. And therefore, it's okay. And not necessarily understanding how the margins that we're dealing with, how those margins get eroded. So what's your experience of operating or speaking, you know, because you spend a lot of time with the frontline operators.
Yeah.
What's their perception of margin and how they're dealing with that, especially with something like stored energy?
I would love to tap into that stop work
stuff.
Yeah,
go for it.
Is it, you know, but I also, you talked about James and the two-faced. James posted this thing probably about 2 years ago or something on LinkedIn, where it was reality representation gap.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember, he talked about that, right? So the guys at the top, they see numbers and colours and graphs and Power BI charts and SMS and all that sort of stuff. Whereas the guys at the front line, they see tools, equipment, resourcing.
Stories.
All that sort of stuff. And that really, really helped me. I mean, you know, I knew that stuff anyway, but when you see it like that,
yeah.
And I would sort of recommend to anybody, if you can get a hold of that graph again, or that graphic again, like really look at it and it helps when you talk to leaders, because I was involved when I started in my last role. They kept talking about Triffa and all that gaff to the frontline teams, and I'm like, they don't care about this stuff.
Yeah,
don't talk to them about it. That's a conversation for you to have for your team. Don't talk to these guys about Triffa. Because it's creating all these unintended consequences, and everybody knows about the unintended consequences of trying to chase down the numbers.
Yeah,
but mate, you talked about the stop work stuff, and Jop Havinga, he was doing some work with an organisation I was working with as well on the stop work.
Mm-hmm.
He done a paper on that sort of thing, and what you've quickly kind of found from that is, people don't go headlong into their death. You know, like they don't go, oh, hang on a minute. You know, like, I'm just going to kill myself here. And then the people at the back go, oh, like, why did they not stop work? In fact, I remember working with a lady, Gareth, who said to me, I'm going to give this guy a written warning because he didn't stop work. And I was like, nah, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, but I've given him this card. I've given him the stop work card. He's got the authority to stop. So I think I should give him a warning. And I was like, I kind of feel him losing the tip of his finger is enough.
Yeah.
It's kind of enough of a lesson, but we'll come back to this. But I really like the way that I think it's Conklin frames up the stop work.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when I was in labour, huh, Gareth. So the only time that I could really control the work is before people started. So if I put 10 people into a factory, I could get guys together and say, right, we're going to have a toolbox talk, and I'd say something like, all right, team, this is the first time you've worked here. Here's some of the work that's going to take place. Can you maybe explain to me some of the conditions or the types of work that might be happening that will enable you to stop the job or slow down the work?
Yeah.
And then they might say stuff like, well, if we don't know what we're doing, I'm like, yeah, right, cool. Right, if you don't know what you're doing, that's a brilliant time to stop. Or and then other people say, oh, if the weather changes or if we don't have the right tools or equipment. But then at the end of it, I would say, right, you as a team are going to hold each other accountable for this now. So if you know something's not right, I need you guys to be a team and sort of back each other up and stop the job. And I'll be there, and I'll come in and I'll challenge the organisation. Because I had to do that a lot. Right? I had to go into your companies and say, hey, if there's 4 or 5 people complaining about this work, it's not an individual problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, something's not right. So that's the kind of way that I like the way that stop work's framed up, and we can always challenge those conversations. And I would really simplify it, like, nobody goes to work to smash their fingers up,
yeah,
or to be killed, or that just doesn't happen. These guys, it's not just a case of, oh, if only they stopped work, you know, they should have stopped. My favorite, they should have stopped the job. I would have stopped a job.
Yeah.
You know, and they could have done.
At the start, we were talking about the different levels within the organization, and we often talk about stop work authority as a sharp end problem. And I did a session just before Christmas with a big offshore support vessel company, and we were talking about stop work authority. And I said, so how easy is it for you? And these were all safety, middle management, senior management people. They weren't sharp end operators. And I said, how easy is it for you to stop the project? Put a pause in at this level. It's like, well, we can't because we've got schedules, we've got budget. It's like, so you don't think that the sharp end operators face those same conflicts that are in place? And it's trying to explain to them stop work authority is not easy. It's an easy concept to describe, but in the here and the now, when you've got lots of pressures and you're achieving those goals. And I think your point about team mutual accountability is one of the bits that I try to bring out in the high performance teamwork is, the sort of development, the training, the deliver is it's about mutual accountability. So if you and I have agreed a standard, I expect you to call me out when I drift or modify my behaviors accordingly. And when you call me out, I don't get all up here about it. Conversely, when I call you out for a standard that we've agreed, now that is a team standard. It should be aligned to the organization standard. If we've got a good environment, a good culture, and the frameworks that are there and the environments there, but it's about our shared looking out for each other. And I think one of the hard bits then is how to create teams, effective teams. If you've got like a labor market there or the work that I did in the oil and gas sector, whereas people used to have close-knit communities because everybody go to the mess hall, they go to the TV room, they go to the smoke shack, and they would build that tight network. But now, because of the sort of the social expectations and the want to help people have a better life, they've got Wi-Fi and TV in their rooms and the cabins, and everybody sort of disappears. And you break down that social fabric and the tight teamwork that happens as opposed to looking out for each other. So it's a really wicked problem is which bit do you start with? And that's one of the challenges of a wicked problem is there are multiple bits of string where you're trying to pull and you don't know which one's going to have it. And it might be when you pull that bit, you tighten a whole bunch of other things and make it worse. And you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. But actually, you've got to pull on strings to see what happens. Because if you don't pull on the string, you'll never know what's going to happen.
Correct. And just because it's a wicked problem, and I've heard people saying this before, does that mean we shouldn't do anything? We can't. And you're like, no. That means don't put these unreasonable expectations on yourself. Particularly around zero or low injury rates or whatever. Things will happen, particularly in the oil and gas sector. These bad reactions to even the tiniest things going wrong. You know the drill, and everybody that's listening or watching knows the drill too. It's just I actually think, mate, that's how you can transform an organisation. If you can just temper your reaction and make it more of a response, that the organisation will change itself, particularly from the senior leaders. And I used to work with those guys a lot, and just, I'd sit there like a bloody little Scottish parrot on their shoulders. just say, remember, you're in control of this. You're in control of this. What response you get is all down to you. And, sometimes afterwards, I remember coming out with one guy once, and he was like, oh my God, I could feel myself getting angry there. I says, but look how much information that you got. Just because you were really cool and collected and, You invited stories from the guys. You were getting amazing stuff. Whereas if you had went in and went crazy, those guys would have all scarpered and disappeared. So kudos to the leaders, because that's a hard gig.
It is.
A hard gig for the leaders.
The bit I'm just thinking of when you're mentioning oil and gas and the power dynamics that are involved, one of the things I hadn't realized is how much going in on behalf of a client on a rig, and they got a bit stuck down the hole. And I was sitting there in the drilling shack and watching what was going on. And to me, it was brilliant from a crew resource management, well operations, crew resource management, human factors situation. I can now see a team operating in an adverse situation. They're now having to deal with a crisis. How do they deal with these things? So I was going around the different stakeholders, and it was interesting because I could see that there were different pictures being created, sense-making by each of the different stakeholders because they were remotely located around the rig. But I said the following day, I said, I'd like, if I can, to do an investigation. I'd like to run, can't do an investigation. You know, but if we have an investigation, there's a whole bunch. So, all right, fine. Can I have conversations then? Yeah, you can have some conversations. Fine, whatever. So I went around the different stakeholders and started to collect the different perceptions, the narratives of those. And one of them was really interesting. So I went to speak to the drilling supervisor, you know, most senior guy in the rig. And he said, I didn't like you in the room. You were stressing me out. I wanted you to leave the drilling room, but I couldn't because you were representing the client, my boss, and you had more power than I did. I was like, oh, I had no idea. And it was just a situation. It's like, that was not my intention at all. I wanted to see what was going on, but there was a perception that we were spies in the camp. It's like, no, we were there as coaches to bring Wakram in place and human factors in place. So I think the sort of the self-awareness of the power dynamics, even though I was teaching leadership and teamwork and this sort of stuff, I was blind to the power that exists and the influence that goes on. It's an interesting piece to share in this situation of understanding leaders have to. And it, you know, even when we're working with the guys on the rig, it took us about, we were on the rig for 5 days, 6 days. It took 2 days to build the confidence with the workers that said we were there to help them, not to judge them. And that's
that's a problem.
Yeah. And if you're only in and out really quickly, you're never going to build that trust.
No, I mean, that's how you said earlier, I really love working with the frontline teams. And I know that I've made it when they start taking the piss out of me or they start inviting me to their barbecues or their team talks or whatever. I kind of know. But it takes time. And I remember a guy saying to me once, you know everybody's name here. That is so unusual. And I was like, what do you mean that's unusual? He's like, he said, we have worked across multiple sites in Brisbane and you knew everybody's name and they didn't have their names on their shops. And he's like, Steve, that is so, like, that's like a superpower that you've got, and not many safety people have that. And I was like, wow, that's really strange and weird. But again, that was because I was deliberate and intentional.
Yeah.
Like, I would go out in the field with these guys, and mate, I wouldn't even talk about safety.
Uh-huh.
I'd be talking about rugby or football or whatever it is that interested them. And that's how you start to hear the second stories and the stuff that comes through. And that's where I get a lot of success when it comes to capturing stories of real work, because people trust me.
You know, just going back to the sort of the second story piece, what would be your sort of approach or for others to learn from in terms of how to explore those second stories? I mean, you talk about building a relationship, it's got to be the first one. But what are the things, you know, sort of curiosity, sort of questions you might ask to explore those things? And you know, we already talked about what does normal look like, but what would you say?
I can tell you a quick story. Like, the questions just come to me. I just say, oh, tell me about this. Help me understand this. I'm just a daft mechanic. I don't get this stuff. Or I'll use the mechanic stuff and say, mate, I know what work's like. I've been in the trenches. I know the shortcuts that people take, and I know the tools that you use, and I know what happens. But I was doing some work with a company, and I got chatting to the teams, and we were doing this big job, but the job sort of had to stop for a bit. I said, talk to me about your truck, you know, like, what some of the things that you do there? And the guy started saying, oh, do you know, like, this is a new truck, and we have to climb on the roof to unhook pipes. I was like, what do you mean you have to climb on the roof? That doesn't make sense. And he says, well, the trucks are not as long as the last ones, so we actually have to climb up on the roof to unhook the long pipes. And sometimes it's raining, sometimes it can be in the middle of the night, and we have to do this on our own. And I was like, all right, cool.
At height without a harness and a full restraint system?
All of that stuff. That's the way some people would react.
Oh, I know.
But I have a more tempered response And so the very next day, I was like, mate, oh, thanks very much for sharing that. That's awesome. The very next day, I went to one of your other sites. I says, talk to me about this new truck. And the guy's going, oh, what a pain in the ass, Steve. You have to climb up on the roof to unhook this pipe. I was like, thank you. And I went to one more site. And I went to another site. And I says, tell me about these new trucks. The boys are saying you have to climb up the roof. And it's like, oh, mate, it's so dangerous. And I was like, thank you. And then that's when you go back to the business and say, hey, you've got a real problem here. The guys are climbing up on the roof of these trucks and we have to fix it. And to be fair, the organisation, they were mortified once they knew it was happening. But it's kind of that thing. Nope, it's not the work. It's not something you're asking about. Yeah. You know, it's like, because nothing's happened, everybody's like, oh, everything's hunky-dory. Like, they're not having any events. But you know, as soon as somebody fell off that Gareth,
you know
what would happen. We'd have the regulators around and that sort of stuff.
It reminds me of my last job in the Air Force was as a requirements manager. So writing these big documents to produce capabilities or procure capabilities. And writing requirements is really hard. And, it was, right, we've got to go out and get hold of the user community and find out how they're going to operate it, how they're going to service it, how they're going to test it, all of those things. But they're busy doing their job, their primary role. And often they don't have time to go through a requirements generation validation process. So they'll get a form and go, yeah, tick, done, yeah, same as before, whatever. And then the procurement team go out there and say, we want one of those. And nobody really, asks that question of what's the challenge? If we take this truck and we go and deploy it, you as the sharp end operators, the expert in what you do, where can you see the pitfalls straight away? Yeah. And it's the difficulty then is when you deploy it and the operators sit there going, oh, the company's just invested 10 million in a whole fleet of new trucks. We're not going to change it. So we're going to have to just get on and do it. And we go back to the stop work piece again.
Yeah, I would actually, Gareth, whenever we introduce new bits of plant, and I would always put a note in my calendar for 6 months. And then I would go back. So we do the risk assessment to onboard the equipment, whatever it was. And I put a note in my calendar, 6 months, go back. I remember going back to the boys 6 months later and saying, right, okay, tell me the stuff that you've done to make this work for you. And I'm like, oh, we had to put this rope up here. To the... And then when you put the truck on a camber, all the drawers slide out and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, man, see, it's like, we, just like you're saying, we don't go, because we're always trying to look at saving money.
Yeah.
The amazing workers, they will always finish the design and make it work for them constantly. I've never worked in a place actually where they've went to the guys and said, right, okay, we're going to spend $10 million or £10 million on vehicles. What do you need?
Yeah.
And I just, for some reason, we just don't seem to do it. And the teams end up just doing it themselves. But then the challenge with that though, Gareth, is I'm again preaching the converted, mate, is the guys will change it to suit themselves. And then next thing you know, all these vehicles are different. They've all got, and then when the vehicles start getting swapped around, they've all got different adaptations and different workarounds and all that sort. I remember one time I got to talk to a guy and he had a crowbar, and crowbars always pique my interest whenever I see somebody using a big, because you know they're trying to move something that shouldn't be moved.
Yeah. A door normally, so I could break in.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, a roller shutter or pallet or something like that. And I said, what are you using that for? And he says, oh, let me show you this. And he went to the truck and he leant through the truck engine and went bang. And the next thing you know, the lights all came on and that sort of stuff. And he says, that's how I start the truck up. And I was like, these people are amazing. And I was like, how do you work out that's what you do? Like, how do you work out that is actually what
needed to be done and work as it was supposed to?
Yeah, and I'm a mechanic, mate, and I wouldn't even know something like that, right? So essentially, he was hot wiring his truck. He was hot wiring his truck with a key. So people are amazing, and people will always find a way, and it's up to us and it's the whole organisation. It's amazing. Just get out there, just ask a couple of questions about, tell me about the work, tell me what, when you're one of the ones that I like asking, tell me what really annoys you.
Yeah.
And you never get a shortage, particularly when you work for a big organisation and it's hard to change. You get lots and lots and lots of answers in. Take a sharp pencil with you, gang.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going to ask people what annoys them.
And it's, having done some stuff in the healthcare space, I would prompt two questions of, you know, what works around here and what sucks. And so, but if we ask what sucks, we get loads of stuff. And there's gripes in there. It's like, yeah, okay. But when you start listening to those, the number of gripes versus genuine concerns, the ratio changes. And the genuine concerns will start to sort of come out. And that's where you can make a big difference. And it's about listening to people. It's about responding to them and saying, yeah, I get that. This is what we need to do. We can't do that because of X, Y, and Z constraints, you know, because the organization's got constraints. But if we gave you X pot of money, how would you solve that problem? You know, and then we are informed, because the other piece is that the frontline operators, when they do that sort of local ingenuity, the adaptations, the workarounds, they've only got their own visibility. It's like having a flashlight torch, you know. They can only see what's illuminated, and that's what their the sort of sphere of influence and control is. But they may be making a change to achieve a local goal that then causes a problem elsewhere without them realizing it. And it's that bit that says, actually, that's where the hard work for the middle managers, the senior leaders is. We're achieving a local goal here, but that compromises a much bigger goal. So you then have to turn around the other way and say, look, to achieve the bigger goal, we have to have a compromise down here, and we accept that. And then you explain and have that conversation. We as the organization are not being a pain in the ass just because we're being a pain in the ass. It's because we've got other constraints that we need to operate. And that's the communication going the other way.
And that's a big system, isn't it? Like, just when you were talking there, mate, it prompted me to think about, I remember when I worked for that labour hire organisation, I had to go to the host employment and do risk assessments. You know, essentially, like, hey, show me your procedures for this, show me that, blah, 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 the next thing. And then I used to have to fill that out in a 12-page form, tick, 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 tick. And then somebody introduced a checklist for that checklist. So I'm like, hang on a minute. So the checklist is here. This is what we need when we go to the host employers. It says, yeah, but we need to make sure that that's completed properly. So that's why we've got this checklist. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Let's just make sure this one's done properly. Ah, but it's not getting done properly, Steve. That's why we need
this. Why not? Design your checklist with human factors concepts in mind.
Exactly.
And put forcing functions and all sorts of stuff in there. So.
That actually prompted me to go, do you know what? Maybe it's time for me to leave this organization.
So on that, we're leaving the third part. The fourth bit
departing.
Is the departing section, which is what is it that you found useful in terms of a book, an article, a video, or a podcast? You can have more than one. And what we'll do is we'll link them in the show notes so that people can sort of come on your learning journey too. So two, three, there we go. What would you recommend that people go and watch and read and listen to?
Right. The reason why I wanted to talk about that mining fatality is I had just read The Field Guide to Understanding Human Error. Mm-hmm. And that book completely changed the way that I thought about risk and safety. It was what I read. And that's why I was frustrated when the guy started talking about it, if only I'd read the procedures and stuff like that. So that was about 2014, I think, I tapped into that book. And that's why I thought I was lonely, because when I asked other people if they'd read that book, they were like, nah, we don't like read that. So that, I have to see everybody have a read at that book. I think it's just like a must read. It's good, an amazing place to start if you're thinking about it. So definitely they. And around about the same time, I discovered Todd Conklin. Mm-hmm. He just launched his podcast, but he wasn't so much talking about HOP. I'm pretty sure in the early days he was talking about HRO and things like that. I'm sure he was. So I had discovered that podcast. And then my all-time favourite podcast, and I wish he would bring it back, and I keep telling
Drew
him.
Ray.
Every time I see him, I say, Drew, you have to bring that podcast back.
Yeah, for everybody else, and it's called DisasterCast. And I'll put the links in there.
And unfortunately, you can't get it on Spotify. You can only get it on iTunes now.
Oh, right.
But I haven't listened to it. I haven't listened to it in ages, so I don't even know if it's still there anymore. But Drew, I'm going to put this plea out to you again. I wish you would do something like that work, because it was just brilliant. And like I say, it was DisasterCast, The Field Guide to Understanding the Human Error, and then later on, Pre-Accident Investigation had the three biggest influences. Yeah. on my career. And I'm a compulsive book reader, Gareth. You know, like, I couldn't even tell you. I'll tell you the books I'm reading just now, though. I'm reading books about creativity and humour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think gets outside
the safety. So you can find out if you're going to be funny at some point.
Yeah, well, mate, I'm going to steal a whole bunch of jokes that you haven't recorded on this and cast them off as my own. So if you're ever sitting in a room with me and I'm on my phone, I'm not checking LinkedIn. I'm stealing your jokes.
I'm reading some stuff on learning theory and actually what goes into effective learning programs. Because, you know, as a content deliverer, is making sure that it's not just a formulaic tick, tick, tick. Ultimately, learning is about creating change, and that means you've got to have something that sticks in somebody's head and makes sense. Okay. And so I'm spending a lot of time working in that space, because ultimately, as an educator, as a learning facilitator, I've got to understand what that happens, and that means I've got to go learning and forever learning. So,
That's why they use humor, mate. Honestly, yeah. I kind of feel that I get, if I make people laugh, they're learning.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, they, it's sticky. It's sticky. They're going to remember it, especially if it's a good joke. It might be a rubbish dad joke, but even dad jokes are memorable.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't have any to tell you just now. Just put me under pressure now.
Stephen, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and hopefully I'll catch up with you soon when you come across this side of the planet. So thank you. All the links and everything will be in the show notes for the stuff that Stephen's recommended, but thank you very much, everybody. We'll see you next week.